You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
And welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode 106. I'm your host, Thomas Smith, and thank you so much for listening. Today, I'm going to talk a bit about this Cenk Uygur stuff. I think that's how you pronounce his name. And then I've got some amazing voicemails. I always love doing the voicemails. They are almost always excellent. They allow me to talk about a range of topics and get some feedback from you guys. So it's really fun. But first, let's talk about Cenk. All right, just want to tell you where I'm coming from on all this. I've never really been a fan of Cenk. I don't really watch the channel. I know I've seen some stuff he says that I agree with. There's stuff I don't agree with, but I haven't really, for whatever reason, it's not as though I've been a fan of his. So I just want to state that because I could really take him or leave him, and I don't really have a dog in the fight. People might think, oh, since he's a progressive, then all progressives will want to maintain his reputation or lie, but I don't really see that as how my community works, and certainly not how I intend to work. I was a huge fan of Al Franken, loved his book, was really thinking he would eventually have a real shot at the presidency, and now no more. It's tough, and it hurts to have to confront the truth about people we look up to, but it's something that I think we all need to be willing to do to finally give victims of sexual misconduct the respect they deserve. And furthermore, so not only that, if Cenk was someone I was a fan of, I would still be all about just trying to see where the evidence leads and going with it. But not only that, he's not even someone I'm really a fan of. So I think, in my opinion, with all my biases or non-biases stated there, I don't see any reason why I wouldn't be able to take an objective view at him. But as always, that's up to you to decide. I just thought I'd give you where I stood on that. But why I'm really interested in this is not so much about this individual person or trying to defend or attack him or anything. It's more about the conversation around hashtag MeToo and sexual misconduct in general and trying as a society to do something really difficult, which is to form a kind of a fair and more just way of dealing with not only this misconduct in general, but just different levels of misconduct, you know, one offhanded comment that someone apologizes for versus, you know, basically Weinstein is always going to be one of the worst examples, just like the ultimate villain doing disgusting stuff, covering it up, attacking victims. I mean, the worst kinds of behavior. There's always going to be a spectrum. How do we deal with it as a society? How do we deal with levels of plausibility of accusations and accusers? Because now that the right is mad that people are finally being held accountable for this stuff for some reason, I don't know why they're mad about it, but there have been all kinds of fabricated accusations and stuff like that. Not something that I would typically think is a problem, but on the internet, when you're looking at anonymous sources on the internet, I think it is a problem because of the bad actors involved. But spoiler alert, nowhere in that conversation is there any place for people who want to call this a witch hunt, say it's gone too far, say that we can't be doing this, and having people, you know, actually believing victims and all that, and then want to cynically use that same movement, that same hashtag MeToo movement, to try to harm their political enemies. There is no room in the conversation for those people, and we should not dignify them by involving them in the conversation. That is cynical, it's evil, it's horrendous, it's hypocritical. Okay, so on to the basics. Cenk Uygur, I'm not a fan, so I don't know that much about his background, and I don't really care, but let it suffice to say that he's a very popular YouTuber. I think one of the most popular YouTubers, actually. He has a channel called The Young Turks. There's some other people on the channel. And I think, actually, previously, Dave Rubin was affiliated with them. He left them, I think. And that's something to keep in mind for later. But at any rate, apparently Cenk used to be a conservative. And some website unearthed some old web archives of like blog posts from 1999 to 2004 or so. And they say some pretty sexist things. I'm gonna read some of it. And as a result, this group called the Justice Democrats decided to part ways with Cenk Uygur. The Justice Democrats is a group that was actually founded in part by Cenk, one of the founding board members. And it's an organization that is designed to support progressive primary challenges against Democratic incumbents to Congress. So it looks like this story was originally broken by a website called therap.com, which from what I can tell, it doesn't seem to have any like ideological agenda. They seem to want to just be an investigative website that reports on entertainment news kind of thing. So who knows? I don't know if, you know, maybe the individual author had some reason that they were trying to look at for blog posts from the early 2000s. I don't know, but whatever. They uncovered it and they're reporting on it. And I don't see them as like necessarily a bad actor in this. But I'm going to go through their article, and then there's another one where I do think it's more of just a smear job that's for another website. But they seem to have broken it. Here's some of the stuff from the article. In an entry from 2000, Uygur complained about not having enough sex while living in Miami. It seems like, quote, "It seems like there's a sea of tits here, and I am drinking in tiny droplets. I want to dive into the whole goddamn ocean. Obviously, the genes of women are flawed. They are poorly designed creatures who do not want to have sex nearly as often as needed for the human race to get along peaceably and fruitfully," end quote. And then there's another one here, rules of dating. Quote, "Women, ignore these at your peril. Rule one, there must be some serious making out by the third date. If I haven't felt your tits by then, things are not going to last much longer. In fact, if you don't get back on track by the fourth date, you're done." He added, rule two, there must be orgasm by the fifth date. That was one. And then, let's see, there's one in 2003 where he wrote about women in New Orleans. Quote, "I had one of the best nights of my life at Mardi Gras. I kissed over 23 different women, saw and felt countless breasts, and was in a wonderful drunken stupor thanks to my friend John Daniels," end quote. Here's another one. In 2004, a post says, "In one small Pennsylvania town, we stopped for gas, and while Cenk filled up, I went to talk to these three girls who were walking down the road nearby. Turns out they were three teenage girls, whores in training, literally looking for boys to pick them up," he wrote. "They were around 14 to 16, and in a few more years will be pretty damn good looking." That was written by David Kohler, who is Senior Vice President of Operations at the Young Turks. Final examples on this rap article are tweets from 2013 in which Cenk said, "The improbable breasts in Miami are only matched by the improbable butts. This place makes LA look real. Just when I think Miami is all done, it pulls me back in. The women on this island are outrageously, almost unacceptably hot." So there's a kind of a whole host of things there. I want to point out that the article, and the reason why I think the rap did a pretty decent job of keeping this to reporting, was they started the article with what Uygur responded, what Cenk said, because they called him, and here's what Cenk said. I think it's important. "In an interview with the rap, Uygur apologized and said he deleted the ugly posts a decade ago because I don't stand by them." Quote, "The stuff I said back then was really insensitive and ignorant," Uygur said. "If you read that today, what I wrote 18 years ago, and you're offended by it, you're 100% right. And anyone who is subjected to that material, I apologize to. And I deeply regret having written that stuff when I was a different guy." Uygur said he wrote the posts while he was still a conservative, before he underwent a political transformation into a liberal. His news organization, The Young Turks, now offers left-leaning stories and commentaries. "If someone said that today, I would heavily criticize them on the show, and rightfully so, and I have. I've criticized myself over the years," he added. "I had not yet matured and was still a conservative who thought that stuff was politically incorrect and edgy. When you read it now, it looks really honestly ugly, and it's very uncomfortable to read." Now, I think that's a good statement, all except the part where he said, "I had not yet matured." He's 47 now, so it was when he was around 30. I mean, I'm around 30. it's possible when I'm 47, I'll think I haven't yet matured. Certainly, we all grow and change our minds and all that, but to say, it's one thing if you were 15 and you said a bunch of weird stuff and then you're like, wow, I was a kid. But when you're 30, 31, 32, I mean, to say I hadn't yet matured is a little odd to me. But what I think isn't odd and is totally fine to say is to say, yeah, I was a conservative. It was terrible, the things I said, which is essentially what I said. If I were him, I would say it was terrible, the things I said. And that's one reason why I try to fight against conservatives now. And I mean, he said as much. I just get rid of the maturing part. Now, there were those tweets from 2013 where he said stuff about Miami and the good looking women and all that. And that, I mean, to me, that's nowhere near the realm of sexual misconduct. People can disagree with me on this. I'm curious if you do, and please voice your opinion with me if you disagree. I think that there's definitely a line between sexual misconduct and misogynistic rants from 2000 that he made. There's a difference between that and just publicly being someone who finds women attractive and saying things like that. Now, of course, you can still criticize him. I'm not saying you can't criticize him, but when we're trying to establish what this like spectrum of creepy weirdo behavior is, I would say tweeting things like, just when I think Miami is all done, it pulls me back in. The women on this island are outrageously, almost unacceptably hot. I mean, I don't really think that's really anywhere on the spectrum of like fireable offenses or stuff we ought to excommunicate someone for saying. I mean, it's a little weird. I don't know that I would say that myself. And especially if someone's really fixated on it and keeps tweeting all this stuff about how attractive women are, whatever. It's not something I really like. But I really don't think it's anywhere in the hashtag Me Too movement. Now, I could be wrong. Let me know if you disagree, but that's kind of how I view it. But there are plenty of comments that I just read of Jenks that I think are really bad and he should apologize for. But this idea that if someone apologizes, has taken those down and they had to be uncovered, like they had to be dug up in archives to then be republished by a website, to hold someone accountable for that, even though they say, yeah, I don't believe that anymore, I was wrong, I took them down. That's nowhere near where we should be as a society. I mean, if we want to get an apology from him, like if you're curious, hey, do you still believe this? Sure. But if you're at all advocating that we need to hold him as accountable as someone who's, you know, committing sexual misconduct at the workplace right now in 2017, that's nowhere near rationality to me. This is a tactic I've noticed a lot online lately, taking things from someone's past and declaring that they forever can never, no matter how much they apologize or say they don't believe it anymore, somehow they can never, ever be okay in society because there's some sort of hypocrisy. I've mentioned it before with what Stephen Knight does to CJ Werlman, where he just posts his old tweets where, again, granted, CJ Werlman tweeted disgusting stuff in like 2008 or 9 or whatever it was. And I actually vehemently disagree with CJ Werlman on all kinds of things. But that tactic of saying, even though this goes against what you're saying now, and even though you've apologized, you don't believe it anymore, I'm still using this against you. All the while, by the way, these same people, a lot of these same people support someone like Majid Nawaz, who admittedly was an Islamist, was an extremist, and believed all kinds of like extreme stuff about Islam. So if that logic were to hold, then no matter how much Majid Nawaz wants to reform Islam and has changed now and saw the error of his ways, we should hold him to that same standard where whatever he said in his worst Islamist phase, when he was imprisoned in Egypt or whatever it was, should we hold him accountable to that forever? No, I think it's okay when someone has demonstrated that they actually changed. And by the way, we're just talking about words. We're not talking about actual crimes right now. I think it's totally reasonable for even in this new witch hunt, warlock hunt times where we actually hold men accountable for stuff. I think it's completely reasonable to allow when it's words you've said or views you've held 10, 15 years ago to be able to say, yeah, I don't believe that anymore. It's wrong. I took it down. Now I want to take a quick look at another article, and this one isn't fair. This is just cynical takedowns of Cenk Uygur. And this is the kind of thing that I don't think we should listen to. And I think we should point out how hypocritical it is for someone like Dave Rubin, who tweeted this, I found this because he tweeted it, to be talking about this when he's had someone like Mike Cernovich on his show, who has actually said and still endorses really disgusting, sexist, misogynist, pro-rape stuff. This is an article on thegatewaypundit.com. If I look at their about page, it says stuff like this. The Gateway Pundit has been cited by Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh on the Drudge Report, The Blaze, Mark Levin, Fox Nation, and by several international news organizations. The editor was also given the Breitbart Award for Excellence in Online Journalism. So that gives you an idea of their biases there. Now, this is an extreme conservative sources that allegedly think this Me Too stuff has gone too far. This campaign, you know, it can't work. It's a witch hunt. It shouldn't be happening. Oh, unless it's about someone we don't like, then it's okay. And one of the first charges against Cenk in this article is a quote where he was debating an anti-feminist. So here's the context of this. He's debating a female anti-feminist activist. And he says this, Karen, give me a thank you. Everything is going great, but you're not being reasonable. You're being ridiculous. Give me a thank you. Give me a thank you for feminists for giving you the right to vote. Otherwise, stop voting and go make me a ham sandwich. So very clearly there, he's saying if it weren't for feminists who you don't like, you would have to not vote and go make, you know, a man a sandwich. That's not sexist. That's pointing out what things were like before feminism. And I hope that we aren't stupid enough to lump that in with all, oh, that sexist comment. He said, go make me a ham sandwich. How sexist. No, that's not what he was saying. So what this article goes on to do is it talks about some of the things I already talked about, some of the old entries that the rap.com broke. And then it tries to add in some more contemporary clips where Cenk is expressing some problematic, maybe sexist views. And here's what I want to say. It is, once again, absolutely okay to criticize anyone who might be expressing sexist views. That's fine. And I think it might be a little bit of this attitude from Cenk that's always kind of turned me off. In a few of the clips I've seen of him, he hasn't been someone I've really just prioritized listening to. And, you know, that's a decision we all should make. So there's something from 2010 here where there's a news story where a man was drugged and anally raped by his ex-girlfriend. And Cenk is kind of laughing about it and says he loves the story and the woman should be exonerated. And I don't find that acceptable. You know, like, that's not funny. It seems like it kind of comes from an old-fashioned gender roles thing, like men can't be victims of stuff. I'm not a fan of that, and I don't think it's acceptable. There's another clip where they're talking about a teacher, a female teacher who had sex with a 13-year-old male student. This is 2009, and Cenk says that he would need to see the teacher, see if the teacher was hot before he could decide if he agreed with the charges. And certainly I find that to be backwards and sexist, and I mean, if it's a comedy show and he's trying to make a joke, like I usually will forgive someone for making a bad joke, if that's indeed what it is, that's one thing. I don't know if that was the format of the show in 2009. Sounds like he was trying to make some jokes and be funny. There are a couple other things on here, but I'm going to give my bottom line. Here's my bottom line opinion. I'm curious to hear what you guys think. Number one, the stuff he blogged about in 2000 and took down and had to be excavated, you know, forensically in order to even find that he says he doesn't stand by and he doesn't believe and he was a conservative and he's not anymore. That is a zero to me. I'm not interested in trying to take down a person over that. And I think the attempts to do so by conservative right-wing websites is an insult to our intelligence and not something we should put up with. But in all this, I will say there does seem to be some evidence that Cenk has some old school sexist kind of views. And I think we have every right, if you are a liberal and someone who is consistent on issues of sexism and issues of sexual misconduct and all, if you are someone who's consistent on that and you want to call Cenk out for that behavior, I think you're more than welcome to. Personally, since I don't pay attention to him, it's not something I would spend a lot of energy on. But like if I were a viewer of the Young Turks and he made a joke like the one he made in 2010, for example, where he said, you know, the or 2009, where the teacher, you know, the woman, so it can't be a crime, that I would write in, or I would withdraw support over that if he did something like that now. I don't know if he still feels the same about that joke. I would be interested in getting a reaction from him. If I were a supporter of his, but I find that questionable. And I will say that if any new evidence comes out, if there's any evidence of actual workplace sexual misconduct, because it does seem probable to me that given some of his old fashioned views and things he said, it's possible that the Young Turks could be a toxic work environment. So if that information comes out, and if there's anyone who's worked there, any women who've worked there who make claims or make charges, I think absolutely I would take them very seriously, and that would be another story. But the bottom line for me is this isn't anything I will accept at all coming from Breitbart-type websites. I'm sorry, you don't get to pick and choose. You do not get to have it both ways. You don't get to say it's fine when the president does it. And by the way, it does way more serious things like actual assault, actual sexual assaults and rapes that he's accused of doing. That's fine. No one cares. Oh, but when there's a YouTube personality who blogged and says stuff that might be sexist, then we're going to go after them. I'm sorry. You don't get to do that. It's one or the other. So if you are a Young Turks viewer supporter, I'd say you have a few questions you might want to ask about them, because some of those more recent things that he said, they are, again, nowhere near sexual misconduct as of now, as of any information we have, but some questionably sexist stuff that I would think it would be worth if you were a supporter of theirs to perhaps email about or something, because I think it is reasonable. If you are someone who takes this seriously in all cases, it's worth looking into. It's time to check the voicemail. And of course, if you'd like to leave a message, that's 916-750-4SIO. That's 916-750-4746. Let's check out this week's messages.
Hi, Thomas. This is Gerardo from Spain, from Barcelona. I just wanted to pitch in on some discussion about net neutrality. This supposed excuse about capitalism driving the innovation on network technologies, it seems to me very wrong-headed. For instance, not only the internet was founded by the project founded by the government, ARPANET, but some of the most common operating systems on servers are based on Linux, which was an open-source operation that is not working by capitalist rules. Also, a lot of open source is the backbone of a lot of things. The World Wide Web was developed for the CERN to be able to communicate between different countries. So basically, that argument doesn't stand a lot if you really know how the internet developed. Great show, long listener, and have a nice day.
Hey, Geraldo, nice to hear from you. Thanks so much. Good info there. I wanted to play that, especially because it's just fascinating history about the internet. And I'm right there with you. I mean, I don't know who buys this argument. I'm just astounded that they would do something that's so obviously just to benefit corporations. I mean, that's who it's for, especially in this country. I don't know what your situation is in Spain, but in this country, as we've talked about on opening arguments, where, you know, two media companies control everything, and that's essentially all there is because we've allowed this wild, you know, monopolizing to happen. And it just means that they're going to throttle the people that they don't like. So, you know, Comcast will throttle Netflix or something. They already were, by the way, and before this. And then, you know, the ones that the media companies that are tied together will benefit each other. And the ones that won't will be rivals. And I think the only person who loses is the consumer, who has to either pay more, buy internet from more than one source, or do, you know, who knows what kind of crazy effects there are going to be on the little guy in this situation. It's amazing how powerless we are over Comcast and the like, you know, these AT&T, whoever it is, these giant communications companies. I mean, there's just nothing we can do. And, you know, even if a majority of people support net neutrality, which they do, it doesn't matter because of the great cuckolding of our nation by Donald Trump. I mean, it's the ultimate, conservatives are the ultimate cucks in this situation because they were, to use their word against them, they thought they were, the swamp was going to be drained. Guys, it's good news, they've drained the swamp, and that's why everything they're doing benefits corporations in the top 1%, like literally everything they do. So it's frustrating, but thanks for the call. Thanks for the history there. That's really fascinating. And I hope you're enjoying our misery over there from Spain.
Hi, Thomas. This is Andy from Michigan. Whenever you say things like nobody believes that, and this is just a little bit of mild criticism. It's nothing against you personally. It's just, it's something that I hear people say, nobody believes that. And I feel like when you're talking to somebody with an opposing point of view, I feel like that's kind of gaslighting, especially when it comes to things like social issues. Because on our side, on the left, we do have crazies out there, and we do have people who say ridiculous things like we want all men to be in prison and women to inherit every aspect of the earth, blah, 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 like crazy shit like that. And I don't know. This might be really nitpicky, and if it is, I apologize, because I really do enjoy your show. But it, stuff like that, I feel like we're gaslighting the other side, and we're maybe not acknowledging bad actors on our own side. And I know that you did kind of mention, like, not listening to crazy Tumblr feminists, people like that, but I see it for more people than just you. And I think that it's an easy way for people on our side to say, hey, what you think about this doesn't matter. Let me know how wrong I am about that. love the show. Thank you very much. Bye.
Hey, Andy, thanks for the call. I also want to note, in fairness to Andy, there was more to that voicemail in the beginning. I cut it for time. It was kind of long. So I just wanted to deal with the second part. So I just want, in all fairness, it wasn't as though he called in just for that criticism. But that's the part I wanted to address. Yeah, you know, I think that's a fair point. I think that the challenge, I'd say what I'm trying to negotiate when I'm saying that is, I very much think the both sides isms are wrong. I think that it's an easy thing to fall into, this sort of center lord thing where both sides have problems. So here, therefore, me right in the middle is fine. And so it's a challenge to see, like, how much you want to cede to the other side. Like, how much do you want to say, well, I know there are just a bunch of crazies on the left, but here's what I think, or something like that. And, you know, balancing that with being accurate, because you're right. And I do say, you know, I usually reference the Tumblr post people that, you know, because you can find way out there stuff. You can find, no matter how good your cause is, there's always going to be somebody who just simply is kind of dumb and doesn't understand it and says things that aren't right and goes too far. You know, that's just how people are, in my opinion. And where it becomes difficult is where, if you believe like I do, that this affects one side more than the other, in that the mainstream right is more polarized, is more conspiracy theory-esque, is less rational. I really do think that's true, because the mainstream right all gets their news from a handful of really, really terrible sources. And they've been bamboozled by corporate interests more so than the other side, to where they're forced to focus on a culture war in order to not notice that things like this tax bill are happening. I really do believe that's the bulk of what's going on here. I think that Republican voices know that their message isn't a winning one. As in, if you polled on the healthcare bill, it polled miserably. If you polled on this tax bill that they just passed, it polls miserably. That's not a winner. So what they have to do is focus on what works, which is culture war. I'm absolutely open to anyone giving me examples, but I just cannot think of many contemporary examples, if any, of Democrats leveraging the culture war in order to distract from passing an agenda that the people don't like. I can't think of that. What I've seen in my lifetime with Democrats is despite, of course, there are flaws. Of course, there are individuals who don't do the right thing or whatever. There are hypocrites, there are scandals, all that stuff. I'm under no illusions that the Democratic Party is perfect at all. But what I see is an attempt to do helpful things policy-wise, you know, trying. And in fact, I see the opposite, trying to do things that help the people, despite the fact that it costs them politically. And so for Republicans, though, I see needing distraction, especially right now. Like maybe throughout history, it might be a different story some years back. Who knows? But especially right now, what we can absolutely say with certainty based on polling and if you just watch a second of Fox News is Republican policy does not poll well. Almost no one wants it. And so they're forced to focus on campus craziness and all that stuff. So that's why I guess it's a little tough to want to grant that too much. Like, oh yeah, both sides have crazy, because we're not using a whole lot of crazy stories about Republican culture in order to distract from agenda. And there's a distance. And even if you could say maybe there is with like the Charlottesville stuff, there's a distance between Democratic leadership and our alleged crazies, quote unquote, and Republican leadership right now and Charlottesville, where you get a response out of the White House that was appalling. That there's a bigger gulf between the radical fringe on the left and the mainstream than there is on the right. So that's a difficulty that I guess I'm trying to negotiate there. But I think you're right. I think your comment is valuable. I'll try to think about it. I also think I want to focus on issues. I really want to focus more on issues. I want to try to, I've been thinking a lot about this. I just think that this is such a distraction, you know, just the nonsense culture war stuff, which, you know, I want to be on the side of compassion toward people of color, trans people, LGBT. I'm not giving that up ever, by no means. But I also want to try to make people on the right aware, if I'm ever arguing with them or talking with them, I really want to try to take a step back and say, okay, what if we just forget about this culture war for a second? Like, how much do we actually disagree on policy? It may be that we still do, but it might be that we don't. Like, I really am, I want to try to arrange a conversation with a Republican or with a Trump supporter, or whoever, about this tax bill. Like, I just want to know what they really think about it, because it's polling terribly. So unless I find one of the very small minority of people, or if the Fox News machine has enough time to churn out a new truth about how actually this is the best thing for us, who knows if that'll change. But I'm interested in that moving forward. And maybe I'll need to rephrase, or instead of saying nobody believes this, say, you know, very few people on the left believe this or something. Maybe that'll be helpful. But that's my long rambly response to your comment. Thanks for the call.
Thomas, it's Felicia, your friend from Utah Outcast. I was calling in regard to your question on the episode with Science Mom. You were trying to speculate as to why so many liberals are anti-GMO. And in my humble opinion, it's the white elitist liberals who, they are the environmentalists who say, oh, just, you know, drive an electric car, or recycle, or, you know, they these things that people who are lower income don't have time for. And liberal people don't even think about the liberal elite people, the wealthy, don't often think about the circumstances of the poor. They just think about how sad they are about it. And I find that they are often the ones controlling the conversation, is just white liberals. They're so obsessed with food that they don't think about making food cheaper, because they're just so used to paying it. So that's just my perspective. It's just white elite liberal. Thanks.
Hey, Felicia, thanks so much for the call as always. And I'm right there with you. And here's the thing. I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. My biggest example that drives me nuts is actually San Francisco, because the greenest thing we could do is build more skyscrapers. and have more people be able to live in a condensed area and utilize shared resources. Like, actually, if you look at scientifically, the best thing for the environment, it's build more skyscrapers because it reduces the carbon footprint. If you have more people together, they can utilize transportation, public transportation that already exists. It's way better than having spreading people out and having them, you have to use more resources in so many ways. And yet, what is sort of the white yuppie liberal thing to want is, oh, don't build those skyscrapers, man. That's totally unnatural, man. It's like there's some weird protection over the sky. I don't know what it is, but I read an article some years back about that, about how there's like restrictions on so much construction in San Francisco, and I'm not sure about other cities, but that was the city in question. And it sucks because if you have a given population, the more of that population are closer together, the more can use those shared resources and it's better for the environment. But I found an interesting thing. So I went back to some Pew research about GMOs, and I found something rather surprising that I wanted to share with you. If you look at the question of percentage of adults who say it's generally safe to eat GMOs, turns out it's actually Black and Hispanic people, a higher percentage say it's unsafe. So the numbers I'm looking at here is for white people, 53% say unsafe, 41% say safe. For Black people, 68% say unsafe, 24% say safe. Hispanic, 65-32. I thought that was really interesting. And the biggest divide actually is men and women. So 65% of women say unsafe versus 28% safe, and 49% of men say unsafe versus 47. So for men, it's pretty split. For women, it's 65-28, with the remainder, I'm sure, going to unsure, but it doesn't say so in this graph. But this is so interesting because that's not what I would have necessarily thought. You know, I kind of would have thought like you, where it's like, okay, white people with a bunch of time, you know, people of privilege with time to sit around and think about these things get to say, oh yeah, that's unsafe, and spend more on like organic or whatever it is. But it doesn't seem to be that way necessarily. I think the men-women split is interesting. I think there could be some gender role action going on there where it's like there's so much societal pressure on mothers to do everything right for the baby, you know, for the kid. So maybe they're more concerned about anything that might potentially be unsafe and therefore are more alarmed at GMOs in food. That's just a guess, no idea. But in terms of Black, Hispanic versus white, I wonder, this is just a total guess, but maybe there's more skepticism of science among people of color since science was used for so long to justify bigotry. Could it be that there could be some well-earned skepticism there? I don't know. I'm not sure. It seems like an alarming split. It's definitely statistically significant, a 15-point split, Black and white there. So that was a surprising result. And the most surprising thing to me, again, is how right down the middle this is politically. Like, the numbers are just so identical. It makes no difference, Democrat, Republican, moderate. Like, it's just a pretty much all even in terms of what proportions of those groups think that it's safe versus unsafe. And that's sad. I think maybe Democrats, you know, there's an opportunity to try to be leaders on this, and to try to say, hey, you know, this is okay. We want to be the party of science. This is okay. Let's, you know, try to raise awareness on that. But I think it's one of those issues that politically it doesn't gain you a whole lot to make that stance, you know, like a labeling law. I'm just talking politically. I mean, obviously, I think most people listening to this show, maybe not, but most people would agree that scientifically, we don't need labels. GMOs are good. They're capable of feeding a lot more people, and that's a great thing. That's how I feel. But politically, there's not a whole lot of incentive to alienate people in that way because a majority of people think they're unsafe. So that's one of those hard political decisions where you have to say, okay, even though this is not popular, I need to try to advocate this. Or maybe this isn't something we should put on politicians. Maybe it's just, you know, scientists, science advocates. Maybe we all need to step our game up and try to reach more people with it. But it's a tough issue. Oh, I would say one of the biggest predictors also is more science knowledge. So actually, maybe that could be the case if there aren't as many people of color who have gotten a chance to get postgraduate degrees, because postgraduate degree is a predictor statistically here of trusting GMOs. So that could explain that split too. Interesting sociological questions there. But there you have it. Just wanted to bring that up because I found it surprising myself. And I'm always interested in those numbers. And I hope we can bring up the number of people, the proportion of people who think that GMOs are safe, because they absolutely are. So spread the word.
Hi, Thomas. This is Nate from Vacaville. Great conversation. But I think you, Aaron, and I think Sam and David Benatar as well are all seriously mistaken about the morality of a universe without consciousness. This is a serious ethical question that I think we may actually be able to answer and act on as a species at some point. And because the ultimate point of philosophy is to try and answer questions that matter, I think you can't just ignore any important question by saying it's like dividing by zero. It's actually literally not true. You can't divide by zero. It's infinity. And the invention of calculus, which enabled the creation of our modern industrial society, depended on an attempt to take the dividing by zero problem seriously. I think that maybe we're still in a pre-Newtonian age for moral philosophy, and that's the reason that this philosophical question seems mysterious. Consider David Benatar's Martian example. If you were to find out tomorrow that there was an ecstatically happy Martian civilization living under the surface of the planet, I think you'd either be an idiot or a moral monster if you didn't think that was a good thing. And the only reason you don't lose sleep over this not being the case is that you don't consider it to be a real possibility, and that using this gut intuition as a logical foundation for a moral system, as David Benatar does, seems to me to be an obvious error. On the other hand, if hell was real, that you could just turn it off, you absolutely should. And God, if he exists in the way that Christians imagine him to exist, would be a moral monster if that was what he allowed to happen. Thanks, Thomas.
Hey, Nate. All right. Lots to deal with there. Here's what I think. I'm not going to have time to properly address all your questions. I think I definitely want to have Aaron back. And I know there are a lot of questions about this specific thing. Some people didn't agree with me on this, so we can talk more about it. But I will comment. I have to say, now, any mathematician, I know I got a lot of PhD listeners, and I love that. Any PhD math listeners, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've had quite a bit of calculus. I've taken through calculus 3. It's not, you know, it's not immediately on my mind to take some refreshment, but you can't divide by zero even in calculus. That's not actually true. The limit of A over B as B approaches zero is undefined. It because if you're slightly in the negative, so picture very, very close to zero, but negative, then you're at negative infinity. And if you're very, 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 very close to zero, but positive, then you're approaching positive infinity, so that limit does not exist. There is a vertical asymptote at x equals zero. So that's a little little math lesson. Now, I don't know, maybe if there's some calculus you know that I don't, that's entirely possible, and I mean that. Someone, if anyone wants to correct me, but I'm pretty certain, since the limit doesn't exist, you cannot divide by zero even in calculus. And I also reject that I was trying to like avoid a question by saying that. I think I want to know what question you think I'm avoiding there. I'm also not totally sure where you're coming down on these issues, because what I just said there, that a universe without any moral, without any conscious creatures is kind of like dividing by zero. That is something that both of them, Benatar and Harris, would disagree with, or they at least said things to the contrary of during that recording. And yet you also seem to disagree with both of them. I'll talk more about that with Aaron. I'll hope he listens to this, or maybe we can repeat the question next time I have him. But there are definitely some commenters that thought, if you don't have any moral being, if you don't have any conscious creatures at all, Thomas, then it's simply zero and not dividing by zero. And I just disagree. Well, actually, first, it depends on what your moral system is based on. So what maybe I didn't say this right, but if in Sam Harris's world, where you're evaluating a system of conscious creatures, and that's where you're getting your morality from. So you're saying, you know, if there is more happiness, more well-being, that's good, less well-being, that's bad. No conscious creatures at all isn't zero. It's not even on the landscape. And I very much believe that to be true, but I'm wondering if I didn't come up with the right words. It's possible I'm wrong, but I, and from my point of view anyway, I'm pretty sure I'm right about that, because I don't think quantity is properly captured by the moral landscape analogy. But keep in mind, I'm just talking about that. If you have some other system where it's like your morality, your values are, it's based on, I don't know, honor or something, then you could say, I know that sounds weird, but you know, that's like one of the old timey moral systems of the Aristotle days or something. But then I think you could make the claim that a universe with no honor is just zero. There's no problem there. I think it really depends on how you're defining morality. But I do believe that morality is dependent on suffering, well-being, those kinds of things. Those are important. And I think it is based on conscious creatures and our ability to feel pain or to feel pleasure, all that stuff. That's what I think it's based on. And so therefore, I think a universe of rocks is not zero on the scale. I think it's, you can't evaluate it. It's undefined, in my opinion. So I don't know if that suffices as an explanation. I'm sure there will still be people who disagree. I'll see if Aaron still disagrees or not, but I look forward to talking about that more with him later.
Hi, Thomas. Matthew Cravat here. We met at ReasonCon 3 the night I supplied Cogdis with donuts, including the second best donuts Diesel has ever had. Thank you very much. I called once before to berate Andrew for mispronouncing Miss Yatilik, and he's done it again. But today I just wanted to call about open primaries. You briefly made mention of them before, and not with Cards Against Humanity level disdain, but still not positively. Here's why they're important to me. I shouldn't have to declare allegiance with Democrats or Republicans in my state with whom I may not agree or support on many issues to participate in the democratic process. I shouldn't have to give gerrymanderers in my General Assembly information to help them disenfranchise me. Here in North Carolina, there are three recognized parties, Democrat, Republican, and Libertarian, or you can choose to be unaffiliated. North Carolina has a semi-closed primary system. That means if you're affiliated, you get the ballot on primary election days for your party. If you're unaffiliated, you simply request the ballot of your choice when you sign in to vote that day. And I think that's pretty fair. Again, I shouldn't have to belong to a party, just choose to vote. But at the same time, if you do belong to a party, you can't simply cross party lines and vote in another party's primary. There's not much good in North Carolina politics other than our great new Governor Roy Cooper and my dear friend Audra, an atheist who just won a seat on our town council and was interviewed by the Friendly Atheist about it. For the record, she was sworn in on the U.S. and North Carolina constitutions, not Aesop's Fables or whatever that book was the other people were using. Thanks for the time. Stop breaking the law, armature, or whatever your tagline is. Have a great holiday season.
Hey, Matthew, such a great call. Thanks. And congratulations to your friend. It's funny, as I heard you say that, the words that formed in my brain was, oh, I should interview her. And then you said interviewed by Hemant or whatever. And I was like, oh, okay. So people can check that out if they want to hear. That is very cool. Congratulations. So, couple things. I respect where you're coming from, absolutely, but I think there's a couple things wrong with what you're saying, in my opinion. And the first is the primaries, people may cringe at hearing this, the primaries aren't the democratic process. So the democratic process is voting in the election. That's the democratic process. The primaries are actually just a private group. I mean, the each party is not a government agency. They are private groups that get to determine whatever they want their rules to be in order to run their candidates. There's nothing in the Constitution about parties. It's not some sort of guaranteed right we have. No one here has a right to determine which candidate our party runs or any party runs. So I just reject that wording of participating in the democratic process. And when I covered that in that episode, I thought the history was interesting, because this did not used to be the case. I don't think you would say voters in 1960, when they elected JFK, I don't think you would say that they had no chance to participate in the democratic process. They did. But even though, despite the fact that the primary was very different back then, and if you go further back, there was almost no public say at all in which candidates the parties ran. While I am all for doing everything we can to limit gerrymandering, I don't actually think it's based on party registration. I think it's actually just based on vote results. Because, I mean, after an election, because that would be the most accurate thing, would be what the voting results were. So let's say in 2020, the next time they're going to draw the lines, I believe, they could take the 2018 voting results to draw those districts, or I don't know how the timing works. Maybe they could take the 2020 general. I don't know. But I believe that's what they're using. I don't actually think they're using voter registration. I guess what I want is some sort of consistency. I wish there was more consistency in the states. I wish that the biggest states went first because, and actually a lot of listeners pointed this out, these little tiny dinky primaries in the beginning, they give just an unrealistic view of what's going to happen. I mean, if someone wins the Vermont primary, whatever, you know, these little tiny states that in the end don't have that many delegates, but give this weird sense that like momentum matters. And if you talk about corn subsidies a bunch before that primary, then it's, you know, like it doesn't make any sense to me. In my mind, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying Democrats as a party get to determine who they run, and therefore closed primaries make perfect sense to me. I would like some consistency, so I would prefer one over the other, like all one over a mixed, you know. And I would say that if they could be limited to registered Democrats and registered like independents, because I just don't think the Democratic Party should be interested in a Republican's opinion of which candidate is better for them. You know, that doesn't really hold a lot of value to me. But if we were doing some sort of negotiating, I would very quickly give up the open primary thing. Like, that's probably of the three things I really care about in the next primaries. And none of these are going to happen, I don't think. The first one would be reorder the states. I think that's like the biggest one. Reorder the states so that the most populous states go first, and because it gives you a more realistic indication of what the end result is going to be, and it doesn't give you a phony, you know, false positive kind of feeling because someone won a tiny state, you know, New Hampshire with a couple of delegates. It doesn't make any sense. There's so much attention on these little states. And sorry, no offense, you know, but it should be New York, California, those kind of things, Florida or whatever. And the second thing I would care about is get rid of caucuses, because I really, that is the ultimate in undemocratic. It makes no sense. It's just prioritizes people who have way too much time on their hands to be able to go spend all day in a room and figure that out. The data shows, as I brought up last episode, that they are not representative of what the state wishes. I mean, and talk about undemocratic. I mean, if you're worried about that, that should be number two. And I would say the closed primary thing is the third thing. I would give that up. Like, I would trade that for the other two. If we reordered the states, we got rid of caucuses, fine, we can have open primaries. That's I will quickly give that up if in a little, you know, bargaining chip there. So that's how I feel about it in terms of the order of priority of those things. All right, let me give a huge thank you to my callers for today's episodes. Call in, get that number on the episode description. Call in with your opinions. There was a lot to react to in today's episode. And indeed, interacting with you guys is my favorite part. And my other favorite part is thanking my new members at SiriusPod.com/support. Again, I am switched to this from Patreon, so if you'd like to make the switch, please do. SiriusPod.com/support. You'll get the RSS feed, all the same stuff. And this week's new members are Marco Rosano. Yes, the Marco Rosano. Dash Riprock. Ditched Patreon for this. Joe Bethersanten. That's one T and with an H in there. What? There's two T's in that. What? Okay. Danielle, feeling blue in a red state. Just listened to the Wayward Willis podcast already. The rambling patron who left Patreon. Thanks, Doug Yenser. Larry, go to Skydive Orange, VA's premier drop zone. Tell him Eli sent you. First Chronicles 28:15. Now, do I need to read that passage? Get back to me. Torsten Peel of ProsperityKarma.org. Jim Ramsey, who makes toxic masculinity cry, and that's okay. That's a really good one. Merry First Christmas to baby opening arguments. Oh, thank you so much. Little Phoebe had a great First Christmas. Shannon E., peace, love, and warm, squishy feelings. Vulnerable transgender fetus. Mr. Bible Pants of the Problem Addict podcast. Cameron Crombie. Pascal switched his payment to SiriusPod.com, and so can you. Ooh, I like that one. Canadian Beaver saved my house from wildfires. Jay Aldenwalt. I've taken legal advice from a podcast, and now I'm on the lam. Sean Washington of the Atheist Community of San Jose. Hey, Sean. Michael Victor Zink. Please don't steal my liver. I'm new in this neighborhood. Thank you so much for being my new members at the website there. Hope you're enjoying it and the extra content. And now I've got to thank those top members on the website who get a recurring shout out. And they are Corey Johnson, host of the Brainstorm podcast and the Hardcore Skeptic, James Hamblin, Andrew, not Andrew Torres, Andrew that is, Left of the Valley podcast, the guy who nitpicks your discussions with Aaron Rabbi, Luke Voucher, Zabby, Marco Rosano, yes, the Marco Rosano, just listen to the Wayward Willis podcast already, and Jay Aldenwalt. Thank you guys for being top supporters at SiriusPod.com/support. And if you'd like to get back on the shout out bandwagon, change your patronage from Patreon to SiriusPod.com/support. If not, that's totally okay too. Thank you so much for listening. Got a great interview coming up Monday with Alex Jules. We're going to talk about the Ta-Nehisi Coates and Cornel West controversy, and I'm sure we'll branch off to other stuff. But I've got a lot of opinions. I know he always has a lot of opinions, and we'll have a good conversation. I'm looking forward to that. So I'll see you then.